We'll go ahead and call the Construction Committee meeting to order. You can take your conversations outside, we'd appreciate it, thank you. We're going to start the Construction Committee. Roll call, please.
Here.
Mr. Murda, you want to start your report, please?
Okay. Can you put that on? Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm giving you the status of the various construction projects in progress, and starting with the 405. The 405 Sepulveda Pass Improvement Project has a couple of significant issues still we are working on, two of them being one with the Getty and Caltrans right-of-way agreement to perform some of the work that we had to do in order to avoid the risk on the relocation of the 96-inch water main. So that agreement is in progress. There have been significant improvements in negotiations. VA, we have gone through many revisions, and we are close to obtaining the license and starting construction in the area there. With the Salvation Army, we are still in negotiations. They are asking us to replace all their environmental units, which we are not in agreement with. So we are working through our legal counsel and their legal to resolve that. Other than that, I think the project is proceeding according to the schedule. We are still working with the City of LA in trying to expedite some of the review process so that we can coordinate better the work going on the Sepulveda lane as well as the 405 project. I can, with that, move to, if you don't have any questions, I can go to the next.
Questions? Not well.
I have a question, not on the 405, but on the other projects.
Okay.
Wait.
No, just, we're going to do it project by project. You can ask your questions as it relates to this specific project. So.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Next.
Yeah. The next one is the Metro Orange Line. I'm trying to get the slides on. Okay, the Metro Orange Line, the significant issues here is the power pole relocations. Other than that, I think we have found a path forward with the City of LA to work these intersections out, and the third-party approvals are still a challenge. We are working with all the various bureaus within the city and get that project moving. The project is on schedule as of today, so there's no other major issues. On the congestion reduction demonstration project, the design build operate maintain contractor has completed 70% of the design, and Metro and Caltrans, we are working pretty closely in trying to get the authorizations and approvals so we can move on. They move the project according to the schedule. DBOM contractor has already started working on the I-10, I-110, as well as I-10 both. And the Crenshaw LAX corridor project, we have received the approval from FAA for partial coverage of the trench. We still have some paperwork to do. If there are no furloughs, as what today's paper indicates, we should be able to get that one online. Project costs, we are still going through our value engineering and trying to come back to the board in October as to the ability to bring the project within the cost that's in the life of the project budget. So we will be back in October. There are some challenges that we are working with FAA. Since we are on the flight path, we need to make sure that the construction activity that's going to take place along aviation conforms to all the FAA requirements. So we are working on that. We had an industry review meeting on August 15th on this room. I'm sorry, in this last September, last week. And we had a great participation. We had almost about 400 major contractors and subcontractors attend the meeting. So there is a lot of interest in getting this project out, and that's what we are trying to do, get it according to the schedule. We are going to put the bid option as directed at the board for the Lemont Park Station, and it will be in the RFP that we are going to issue in January. We have some good information with our negotiations with BNSF Track. They have agreed for the abandonment, and this allows us to bring the project within the budget. It's one of the components that was important for us to accomplish. We are started the right-of-way certification and acquiring process on that. Regional connector, we are working on the preliminary engineering. PE of the project is about 50% complete. We have essentially completed all the geotechnical work on it, and we are trying to finalize with the FTA the roadmap as to the future activities, how we are going to do it. Value engineering recommendations have come in, and we are working through those, and we are also working through our operations to make sure that some of the recommendations does not impact our operations and maintenance. On the west side subway extension, the admin draft for the final EIS EIR was submitted to FTA on time, as we said we would. Preliminary engineering is in progress, and preparation of the RFP package for the final design, we have just started it. You know, there are many unknowns in the west side, like fossils and tar sands, and also we have to make sure that the engineering is properly done before we move forward with that project. We are also working with the FTA to finalize the approvals. There have been some setback in the review process. They want more time to review the documents, so we are trying to work through those schedules. And real estate is working on, according to the schedule, on the subway project. That concludes my part of the presentation for the metro projects, and next we can go to the Expo Light Rail. Yes.
Or on the expo?
On the ones prior to that, he was giving them one by one.
Okay.
Now, Ms. Murthy.
Yes, sir.
In your report.
We're not on.
Can you give us an update on these projects with respect to the timelines, whether we're on track? The ones you just went through, are we slipping on any of them? Are we ahead of schedule on any of them in terms of the completion time frames?
Yeah, I think the next presentation is on the project budget and schedule status, which Brian Boudreau is going to make. He has all of these projects on his presentation. He will show the cost and schedule as to where we are.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Okay, next.
So, can we move to?
I have a question on that, Mr. Chair. Mr. Murthy, on the regional connector,
yes,
a decision was made to do value engineering to control costs.
Yes, sir.
What is the process for the board and the public to see the changes that are being made to the stations or any of the as a result of the value engineering? When will we see that and see if we agree with it? When can we have some input on that?
When we come for the EAS, when the final approval for that prior to issuing the RFQ, we will be making the presentation to show exactly what the project is all about. So we'll be doing at that time.
Okay. I've heard some concerns that although we do have to watch how we are spending our money and we need to save wherever we can,
yes, sir.
You know, we need to make sure that the public has an opportunity to give some input on any changes that will be made or any station changes as a result of the value engineering as we move forward. So I just want to make sure we give them that opportunity.
Yes, sir. We will definitely do that. With that, can we move to exposition light rails?
Yes, I just want a clarification here and checking with my colleagues and their staffs. Item number 63 in our agenda. I know there's some people here in regards to that item. There was a new motion introduced at EMC and passed to the full board. And so it is our recommendation then to take item 63 and move it to the full board with that new motion. Okay, so we won't be rediscussing. So I know many of you had discussed it at great length at the previous meeting. We're just going to take the new motion as presented and move it to the full board. So there will be no discussion on item 63 at the construction committee.
Motion now?
Yes.
So moved.
Second.
Moved and seconded. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. So I know that I didn't realize that there were so many, so I just wanted everyone to know. So it will be next week. Probably didn't want to be redundant anyway, right? You didn't want to do it twice. Go ahead.
Should I wait for the slide? Just go ahead.
Yeah.
On phase one of the Expo project.
Right. There we go.
There we go. On phase one of the Expo project, as of this date, our contractor still is not substantially complete. As I reported at the last committee meeting, we have begun to assess liquidated damages as of July 17th. So those continue to accrue. Clearly, our goal is to get the contractor wrapped up and get Metro onto the alignment. Our independent assessment of the schedule, we're estimating substantial completion mid to late October. With that in mind,
What year?
This year.
Okay, thank you.
With that in mind, we're working with Metro so we can get their operators onto the alignment to begin to get familiar with the alignment itself. So what we've done is we have the junction with the Long Beach Blue Line, which is really the more complicated piece of work and schedule dependent on the ability to close revenue service over the weekends for the Blue Line. So that's a longer lead item. So what we're focusing on is the segment from Trade Tech to La Cienega. We had hoped to have Metro beginning this operator familiarization on Monday. It looks like that will probably slip a week to the following Monday is the plan to wrap up the testing on that segment the end of next week. So we'll have to see how that progresses. And then the remaining elements, once the junction is tested out right now, hopefully sometime early to mid-October, then we could turn the entire alignment over to Metro so that they can continue to do their operator familiarization on the line. With doing this, we think that the December rod date is still viable, but certainly at risk, so we're going to continue to work closely with Metro to try to hold that date. The remaining elements of work on the project, namely the Farmdale Station and the Culver City Station, are still scheduled to be complete sometime in the spring of 2012. On the project budget, we were able to make some progress on the budget. We are now projecting a $3.5 million overrun, plus any contractor claims or other unknowns. We were able to realize a few of our value engineering reductions. That's why we were able to reduce the forecasted deficit. We continue to process value engineering reductions. We've still got about $1 million that we're working towards there. Continuing with our third-party reimbursement costs, which we estimated $4 million. And then we have some other potential savings, deferments of items, things like that for $1 million. So if we're able to realize these and continue to work positively towards the budget, we think we can close this certainly known budget deficit. So we'll continue to work on that.
A couple of committees ago about the overall budget for Expo One. When will I be getting that?
Mr. Boudreaux sent out to all the committees members.
Sorry, I didn't hear you.
Mr. Brian Boudreaux sent out the status of the cost and schedule on the Expo Phase One to everybody. I will verify. I think Brian is here in the audience. Maybe he can answer the question.
I'm talking about, remember, I wanted to know from beginning what it originally cost, what it costs, all of the escalating costs along the way, the overall budget, and all of the changes that were there, and what changes were made that escalated the costs, and what was the rationale for some of them. I've been waiting for this report now for almost 2.5 months. You think it would be something you could readily put together. Did you not understand what I had requested?
I did, and we did send out basically a white paper that summarized the history of the cost.
And have the data on it.
Okay, we can certainly provide more detail.
But it's very simple. You start out, you're going to spend $100 to build something. Okay? Then you start building it. Now it costs you $150. All right? So then you tell me what was the $50 for. Okay? Then you continue building, and it goes up to $250. Then you tell me what that cost was and why. It's a simple process. We should know because this has escalated dramatically. And it's just that you don't tell me, and I'm trying very hard to get my hands on it. It's just like you telling me your project budget now. You're telling me that we may be impacted by $3.5 million? Okay. These were forecasted overruns. We knew that when?
Well, we've been reporting these for the last several months. The forecasted deficit.
See, that's what I'm saying. I never know exactly what you're telling me because you give me numbers and I don't know how to operate within them. So you'll go back 6 months from now and you'll tell me, you know, at the September meeting, we did tell you about this. I don't know what it is. I think that we should know what it is. Now, who's approving these things?
Approving what things?
The over-budget things.
Well, I mean, it's reported to our board on a monthly basis and then coordinated with Metro.
I know, but where do you get the money from?
Well, right now, I mean, it's a forecast. I mean, right now we do have money to build the project. I mean, right now all the costs are within budget. This is just a forecast of what we anticipate could be additional costs that could put us over budget.
Well, that's what I'm talking about. So are you spending it?
Not at this point in time, no.
But what would it be? It's just like if I bought something, you know, and if I bought a car, and but I didn't want to spend the money for the tires, it wouldn't do me a bit of good, you know. So is it something really essential? Or, I mean, is it windshield wipers for the choo-choos? What is it?
I mean, it's a number of things. I mean, it's additional third-party costs, possible change orders.
Mr. Chairman,
trying to get a handle on this budget because they keep coming to me and telling me that they're doing it just like this. I don't know what it is. And, you know, I don't know where they're going to get the money. And so this processing value engineering, what is that? I mean, I've heard of value engineering, but I don't know what is it. Is that a different term, or that means you're in the process of finishing those value engineering items?
We're in the process of now negotiating the credits back from our contractor.
I mean, so then it isn't really value engineering in the term what value engineering means. It's negotiating to get money back that you don't think you should have paid, right?
Well, it's looking at elements of scope and looking at ways that maybe we can do things differently to reduce the scope, to reduce the costs. And so
scope. I thought it says up here that you're in the process of opening it up for testing and pre-revenue operation.
But that we still have the elements at the west end of the job in Culver City. So those are elements that we've been negotiating.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if we have to do a formal motion, but it just doesn't seem like this group of folks want to tell me what I need to know. How is it that I could get it?
I'd be happy to provide the information to
I understand.
The
you keep saying that.
No, I'd like to provide it to you, and then we can look at it and be happy
to
come and
meet
with
you. I
understand,
but I don't want a white paper on it. I need to know, just like I said, start out with a certain budget, okay? Then it went up. What made it go up? Okay, then it went up again. So, and how did these approvals work? Having been a part of the red line, I saw this over and over and over again, and they kept telling us that, you know, these were engineering corrections, there were all kinds of things. And it's just seeing that this keeps escalating every time I see it. Every time I see it, this keeps escalating. So I never understand where I'm going with it. Now, we gave it a lot of money, a lot, over its original budget. It's my understanding there are legal issues, like the red line, that are going to require a lot of negotiation and a lot of legal maneuverings. So it may cost us much more than even what is estimated at this point in time. So I really need you to really make some effort. This board is entitled to know. It's money that it, and we need to know when we're approving this, who approves this, what is it exactly. So when you use terms with us, we're lay people on this side, although maybe some of the folks know more of it than I do. But when you say $3.5 million forecasted overruns. I don't know what that is, and I don't know within the framework of your saying within budget, you're within budget. So it doesn't add up to me.
Well, why don't we'll put something together. I'll work with the Metro staff.
I understand, but I've been asking now for 2 months. What is it that I'm trying to be very clear. You don't seem to get it.
Could I just maybe?
Sure.
To agree, because I raised this issue with Mr. Murthy when I saw that dollar amount, you know, how, what, why, where. We started with the base amount, actually raised the base amount originally.
Correct.
Okay, then you had the issue of the PUC ruling, which added cost. I mean, all those thresholds, that's what she's asking for. That's the additional cost. I mean, a lot of our additional cost in Expo has been things that are sort of outside our control.
Added scope.
And then obviously contractor issues.
But so contractor issues are big ones because that's what's the
problem. I know, but I'm just saying that there's a value on that, that you can just break it out that way, and that would be exactly what we're looking for.
Okay.
It's a simple
motion.
And it's simple, and just do simple math and explain things. We're not engineers on this side, at least I'm not. And so it would be helpful. I've been keep asking for it, and it's annoying me that you're denying me this information. So I'm going to tell you that I'm going to continue to be persistent, just like I'm expecting my universal bridge budget very soon, Mr. Murphy. I think it's now a year since you told me you were going to do that.
Legal people are handling between back and forth.
I just asked you for the budget. I can handle the legal people in closed session. You owe me a budget.
Okay. Won't be long now.
They have not approved what we have wanted to build, so that's where the...
And I just want to...
I just don't want this to be a year from now, my asking the same thing.
I just want to validate her persistence.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
One final question on this,
Mr.
Chair. When you say there's a $3.5 million forecasted overrun, is that on above the contingency? Every project has a contingency.
Yes, that is above the
contingency. So the contingency is gone.
Yes.
And how much was the contingency? What percent of the overall project?
This is a second contingency.
Yeah. I'd have to go back and check that. I don't know it off the top of my head, but it was probably about, I'd say, 5 to 10%.
So then, as Ms. Board Member Molina brought that up, it does beg the question, well, where do we get this $3.5 million? Because, you know, every budget does have their contingency. Where do we go get this money?
Well, as I say, right now we're following the cost containment strategy, which is now to look at things that we can do within the project itself, the value engineering, the third-party reimbursements, and the other potential cost savings. You know, if we're able to realize those, we think we can close the $3.5 million. If we're not able to, then we'd have to start looking at...
And what part of the project is this? If you're saying from conception to completion, where would you say we are in finalizing this project? We're
98%, 95%.
95% there.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. It's not. Okay. We'll move on.
On the second phase, we've begun work there. We have awarded two contracts, construction contracts. One, the main alignment contract to Skanska Rados, that came in within our budget. We've also awarded a contract for the bridge over Venice Boulevard, which is the extension, the first piece of work after phase one. That work also came in within budget, so both of those are encouraging trends. We still have other areas that we continue to manage from a budget standpoint, the maintenance facility construction contract, any kind of modifications we need to do to a very large storm drain down Colorado Boulevard in Santa Monica. We're doing potholing to identify any unidentified utilities in the base bid to get that work wrapped up early. We've submitted our applications to the PUC early and hope for approval sometime next month. We're working closely with LADWP and Edison to make sure we get the overhead utility line relocations done ahead of schedule. And then we continue to work to monitor the legal appeal on our environmental documents. So these are risk elements we continue to manage against. With that, that concludes my presentation.
Do you have some additional questions on next one? Okay.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
We have Mr. Chris Berner from the Foothill Extension for presentation.
And just as a follow-up, if you have any clarification, you can see either Supervisor Molina or myself on the information we'd like to see. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning.
We awarded our alignment contract to the joint venture of Kiewit Parsons. We're very excited about that. That's a major milestone in the project. That is for all the fixed facilities and systems associated with the project. However, prior to issuing the notice to proceed, we need to acquire 50% of the maintenance facility property. That's a condition outlined in the funding agreement between the Construction Authority and Metro. We also have a CEQA challenge of the SEIR. We have a hearing scheduled for October 26th. We are expecting a decision at that hearing. We have coordinated our
efforts.
Who
filed the challenge? Who filed the challenge?
A private property owner on the site where the maintenance facility is going to be located.
Okay, I remember now.
We've been in close coordination with the Metro County Council, and we, as I said, the hearing is scheduled for October 26th, and we are expecting a decision at that hearing. We've begun construction on the I-210 bridge. We've completed the site preparation. We've begun the foundation construction. We have one large pile in the ground. However, the design builder is reporting a 60-day delay on this project. I want to make it very clear that this delay has absolutely no impact on the overall project. There's about 5.5 months of float built in between when that bridge has to be complete and when we turn it over to the follow-on contractor. Also, the design builder is working on a mitigation plan to reduce or eliminate that delay, and so we feel very confident that that will happen. We also need to obtain the permits for the San Gabriel River Bridge. We anticipate those permits to be secure by the end of this month. So that concludes the presentation, unless there are any questions.
Any questions? Ours to Gold Line Extension.
Yeah, when the individual filed the SEIR legal challenge, the eminent domain, were they eminent domain proceedings, or did he voluntarily?
We have begun eminent domain proceedings.
So that's still
on
so
that
he's got two lawsuits with us.
Well, we have he has two lawsuits with us. One is the CEQA challenge. The other is a lawsuit challenging our ability to purchase property from the Monrovia Redevelopment Agency. They own property on that site as well. And then we have filed eminent domain proceedings on his property, yes. And that hearing is scheduled for sometime in November. I don't know the exact date.
And you feel comfortable that none of these proceedings will delay the project?
We feel reasonably confident at this point in time. Obviously, we won't know until the hearing is complete. We have developed, a defense to these accusations, and we'll find out come October 26.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. I do have a public comment on item 35. Mr. Sutton.
My name is Christopher Sutton. I'm an attorney from Pasadena. I represent the property owner in that site. We do have two lawsuits pending. We have a complaint with the Attorney General. And really, the Gold Line needs the same kind of questioning that Ms. Molina gave to the Expo Line, because, in fact, we're filing two additional lawsuits, and the report from the staff of the Gold Line is really incomplete regarding the details of our second lawsuit, because Judge Jones, back on August 31st, gave us leave to amend and stayed the proceeding until mid-February 2012, so that the Gold Line's ability to deliver this facility is seriously in doubt, and that either we win the CEQA case or we win the case against Monrovia, we will stop this facility from being constructed. In addition, we believe there are other issues under CEQA and other issues under state law, and we'll be filing those lawsuits in the next week. And I don't believe that the Gold Line facility and the Gold Line staff is being honest and complete with Metro. I believe the Gold Line cannot perform under their funding agreement. We believe that Metro needs to consider terminating or delaying the funding of the Gold Line so that it can fully fund the other aspects of its system, which it has suspended or terminated, the 5th and Flower Station, Leimert Park Station, Westchester Station, the rest of the Crenshaw Line improvements that have been taken off the table, because the Gold Line is, in fact, the lowest ridership, most expensive per mile project. And
right,
it needs
an overall
examination of this. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I could request either in closed session or report after that October deadline to see how these proceedings, the result of those proceedings, going to determine quite a bit on this, the construction of this project. So
okay, we'll report back after the hearing.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Anything else on item number 35? That you finished, Mr. Murthy?
Yes, sir. Next one is number 62, receive and file on the project budget and schedule. Mr. Brian Boudreau will make the presentation.
Of course,
Mr. Chairman, let me just preface Mr. Boudreau's remarks by saying that every month I've asked Mr. Boudreau, who is the executive director for program management here, whose job is to oversee progress of schedule and budget on all of the projects that we're responsible for, both in-house and out, and done by other authorities. And so Brian's going to be presenting monthly in a easy to understand format what we his objective assessment of the status of the budget and schedule of all of these projects.
All right. Good morning. Thanks, Paul. First of all, this format is something we're working on, and we welcome your comments in terms of ways to make this report more useful to the board members. First of all, this is a summary of the project schedules for our major construction projects. It kind of goes over where we are on the various aspects of these projects in a summary level. We've also attempted to assess, as Paul said, the budget and schedule for each project at the aggregate level and also to identify some potential risks. The first project I want to address today is the Orange Line Extension, which, as was noted earlier, is well underway. And at this point in time, we have no negative reports regarding the project. In fact, the budget is considered to be in quite good shape, and there's we're looking at some possibilities of perhaps some cost savings on the project at the end. And likewise, on the schedule, even though there's some potential risks to the project schedule, we still feel that it's achievable to get this project done by mid-2012.
Is that on schedule?
Yes. Okay. Yes, it's currently on schedule. And we assess it on a monthly basis, so we will be trying to, you know, bring you up to date on any of the issues that come up that could impair our ability to deliver it by the completion date. Crenshaw LAX project, on the budget side, as was noted earlier, there's still some issues that need to be resolved on the cost side that we're hoping to mitigate by the time this item comes back to the board for adoption of the project budget in October. Right now, there's about a $33 million variance that is narrowing as they continue their efforts to in cost containment on the project. And then from a scheduling standpoint, there's not a scheduling issue at this point in time. We still expect that this project can be complete in 2018. West Side Subway Extension, still going through the environmental review process. We've got a cost estimate right now that's been delivered by the consultant that's being reviewed by the Federal Transit Administration. Currently, the project is budgeted at $5.3 million and is scheduled for operation in 2022. I should note that these schedules I'm referencing assume 30-10 funding, and particularly in the case of the West Side project, that would be a key factor. Regional Connector, likewise, is going through the environmental review process, and FTA is reviewing our cost estimate, which currently stands at $1.4 million. With a scheduled revenue operations date of 2019. Exposition phase one, given the fact there was significant discussion on this this project earlier, I won't belabor it too much, but obviously there's some budgetary issues that need to be resolved that we're looking at, working closely with the expo staff. And likewise, on the schedule side, there's some significant challenges there to get this project operational to La Cienega by December, and then also all the way out to Culver City by early 2012. Exposition phase two. Recently, there was a groundbreaking on the project, and the contract was awarded a couple months prior. So it's proceeding on schedule and within the current budget of $1.5 billion. And we, based on the information that we reviewed, we don't see any reason for concern at this point on either the cost or the schedule of this project. Gold Line Foothill Extension. From a budgetary standpoint, there is one item I wanted to note, is that we feel that the contingency levels on this project are fairly low. They're about 6% right now. So we're going to be recommending that that contingency be increased to about a 10% level, which is consistent with the process we use on metro projects and industry practice going into construction at this phase. So that's a part of our recommendation. I'll also be discussing it in a receive and file report later on today. And then schedule-wise, because of the issues that were mentioned earlier regarding a few lawsuits, there's a potential schedule delay there that we're going to keep our eyes on, and we'll be reporting on what we think that's going to do to the project schedule as it develops. And that concludes my report for today.
Mr. Boudreaux, I know a couple months ago we talked about this agency and how it could work harder to stay on budget, on time, and even under budget. And it troubles me when I hear you say that you want to go back to a 10% contingency level when you've already established a 6% one, which seems to fly in the opposite direction of where, you know, we had talked about a few months ago.
Well, on all of our projects, metro projects, and this is consistent with the federal guidance that we have for our federally funded projects, we generally like to have a minimum of 10% contingency when we enter into the construction phase on a project. Obviously, you can go in with a lower level of contingency, but you're going to increase your risk that perhaps you're going to go over your project budget. So in the interest of full disclosure, going into these projects, we feel it would be appropriate to have an adequate contingency so the likelihood of having to come back to the board for additional funding gets diminished.
Is there damage or at undue risk associated with not staying at the lower level of contingency that was originally established on this project?
Certainly there's a risk that our history has shown on various projects that we've built as well as other projects is generally you can expect, you know, roughly a 10% increase on what they call known unknowns, things that you don't really know yet but generally will occur in these projects. So going forward with a 6% contingency certainly would raise the risk that I'd be back here again somewhere down the road possibly asking for more money for this project, for a given project.
May I ask in your experience, I mean, you've held this position for a while, and prior to that, you've been around the agency. Has it been your experience that that this agency stays within the contingency allowance, or that it goes above or below it?
We generally like to use this particular, in this particular point in time, we generally like to go into a project with 10% contingency. In some cases, we've actually had above that amount, in some cases slightly below because of special circumstances.
That's not my question. My question really is that whatever the contingency allowance is, has it been your experience in observing what this agency does that we stay above it, we go above it, we stay below it, or we stay on track with it? What's been your experience and what you've observed?
Well, we've had, based on our current policy, we've had very good experience in our recent projects. For instance, on the original Orange Line, we actually completed that project within budget, actually a slight savings. On the North Hollywood Extension, we actually completed that project on budget, on schedule. And then most recently, the East Side project, we were able to deliver that project within budget as well. So we've had recent good experience in completing these projects according to this contingency policy.
Well, given that track record, then why would you be urging us to increase it then?
My recommendation is to make it the same as Metro's projects, 10%, because currently it's at 6%. So I'm recommending that the Foothill project use a 10% contingency consistent with Metro projects.
And the Expo 1, was that a 10%?
When Expo 1 started, they had a 3% contingency, which clearly was inadequate, which explains some of the issues that occurred. There wasn't enough money available to cover some of the scope growth and other changes. So that made the cost increase that much more dramatic, I believe.
Yeah, sure.
The problem is it's never a real contingency. I mean, nobody holds on to it. if it was real and you said that's all I'm going to spend, this plus the contingency, everybody always comes back and just ups the contingency. So if you start with a larger amount, there's nothing that guarantees that you're going to stay there. That's the problem. If you were to sign in blood now that you'll stay within that 10%, it would be refreshing. But what I know will happen, and you may not be the person to say it to me next time, is you'll tell me about some kind of technical difficulty. I've heard them all. And then you'll go up 3% and 2%. Before you know it, it's 15 and 25%. So contingencies aren't honored here. So it's sort of, that's what's awkward about this discussion. I mean, I'd appreciate an honest contingency amount. There is always unknown in any construction. I mean, you can go rehab your bathroom and you have unknowns. But the problem is we don't seem to hit the mark ever. And so we go, we put in a contingency, and then we reach that, and then we go up, and then we reach that, and then we go up. And then there's a liability lawsuits that take us up here. We're still trying to resolve the red line. How old is that? So I appreciate the discussion, and I really, you know, and you're trying to tell us we should now be more realistic, but it doesn't mean it's like anything that's going to be honored. How could we create something that would be honored? I tried to put in a motion that everybody's budget would stay within their budget, and if they didn't meet their budget, then they would have to downsize the project. But there doesn't seem to be, it's not being honored. And what's going to happen is that all of these projects that we're working on today, and most of us who won't be here in 10 years looking at these issues, we're not going to leave much for folks to deal with, because we are using up all of the money and really taking it out of the hands of the future. And I really think we need to find a way. I could appreciate an increase in the contingency, but it's not honored around here. So if it were truly honored, I would be the first one to move it forward. I don't know if that's what you're trying to get at, Mr. Wilson.
Yes.
But and no one will step up. I don't see management stepping up.
Well, I think the important thing now, I mean, in relation to that, I mean, it's a concern that I've had from day one about some of these projects. Contingency or no contingency, you know, the less tight we are on contingencies, the more problems we're going to have down the road with Measure R projects. I mean, that's the whole issue here.
But the point is that they don't honor contingency. They don't honor contingency. There's something called the life of the budget that keeps changing. Mm-hmm. Now that's with the new term that they're using. But I don't think in the private sector, you know, that they can build things with such huge budget, and there's a point in time when somebody says, oh, we got to downscale it because we don't have enough money. But here, you just keep yanking money out of the bag, and eventually it's going to be empty.
If I could make one comment on that, Director Molina, I think the board recognizes some of these challenges, and as a result, they passed this cost containment policy a few months ago, which has a very deliberate process that requires us to go through that process every time there is an acknowledged increase in the project budget. So, and many of those reductions...
I understand, but we see increases here all of the time. I mean, we passed that about 4 months ago, and I'm not seeing one project that's gone through it. Do you know of one yet?
Well, Mr. Chairman,
yes.
Director Molina, all the projects are going through that.
Except for the last line where it says that if you don't have enough money, you have to take it out of the same project.
The policy doesn't say you take it out of the same project. It says you take it out of the same region.
So and have you done that?
Well, we haven't been faced with that yet. But as Mr. Olson from the Expo Authority reported, they are working within the cost containment policy set by the board with the value engineering and the other cost reductions that he was describing. So I think that the board's policy is having a very beneficial effect, and the effect that you intended when you introduced the seed for that policy. And I think you'll see as we go forward that projects will be living within the budget that's allocated. They'll have to be, because we're committed and devoted to delivering all the projects, and we know the only way we can do that is by sticking to the budgets as we go along. So I believe you'll see some. If you can call it refreshing, and I think you'll see it.
I look forward to it,
Mr. Wilson.
Yeah, let me see if I can get to another question, and this is directed to you, Mr. Boudreau, and Mr. Murthy, and whomever has the answer. When you are establishing a contingency percentage for a project, what do you take into account to determine whether the contingency should be 5, 3, 10, whatever percentage that you happen to associate with it? What are you looking at?
Since majority of our projects are underground projects, so we have to expect some unknowns when we do the actual engineering or when the contractor gets in to do the tunneling or excavations. So toxic material, as a matter of fact, you know, even though we do a lot of core borings, we might have missed an area where we have not found this information, and when we start excavating, we will probably come across this hazardous materials, which we have to take care of. That's number one. Number two, utilities. In spite of all our...
What was number two?
Second one is utilities, existing utilities along the streets. In spite of all our pits that we do in advance of engineering, sometimes we would not have found all the existing utilities and their importance to the service. Even the city records sometimes does not tell us all the existing utilities. So we find some surprises as we get into these excavations and actual construction. And as when the projects move along, these are long-term projects. There are some changes by code or by the city or state mandated changes that they want us to do, which is not envisioned when we do the preliminary engineering. So these are some of the things that usually drive us to go into contingencies. In fact, the next item on the agenda, with number 37, is one of those.
So if I got it right, the two drivers behind the contingency factor is, number one, toxic materials, because we're mostly dealing with underground, subsurface kinds of activities, and number two would be utilities. Is there anything else?
The city and state mandate changes to the codes and standards to the projects, you know, sometimes those come into picture. And then in the... Finally, when the contractor starts working, he may find the conditions of the ground or the information provided in the documents. If we are the final designer, then they will come back and for a change on those things. If you go into design build, then the design build contractor will be totally responsible for the complete design.
And would you say that this theory that you just expressed to me, is that something that's a national standard, too? Is it just something that our agency...
Yes, sir. In fact, the Corps of Engineers, their records say that if you are within the 10% contingency of the life of project budget, your project is according to the cost matrix that you have provided.
Now, let me see if I can go back and ask a couple of follow-up questions to your theory. The projects that you went on over with us today, the Gold Line, the Expo 1, Expo 2, the Orange Line, to a large extent, most of those projects are not underground projects. Would you agree?
Orange Line had a lot of excavation, as a matter of fact. We had to take out the old existing railroad, so the extent of toxicity in that existing ground conditions was much higher. So that condition was there. I think Expo Phase 1 had the underground excavation near the USC and Adams Boulevard, that area. So I believe they had some... unknown conditions that they came across.
But don't they compare, pale in comparisons to, for example, the Red Line, the Purple Line, and some of the other lines that have been primarily underground lines?
In terms of when you say payload.
Comparing the uncertainty, comparing the unknowns, which is what you said you use as your threshold.
You're absolutely. The above ground work is definitely in a much more known rather than the underground. So
I'm still not convinced then that these contingency ratios or percentages that you're associating with the projects that we have coming forward are really in line with what you just told me. Because what I'm seeing, unless I got it wrong, a lot of these projects that we're proposing are not underground projects. They may have some small areas that are subsurface, but for the most part, they're not. And so I'm trying to figure out how you associate these high contingency factors, even though you say this industry standard. I'm not sure if the industry standard, if you're taking that into account with those projects that may be primarily above ground like San Jose and some of the others, or are you comparing it with all of the projects nationwide and not taking into account those projects that are very similar to the types of projects that we're doing? So I think that, you know, I'm very uncomfortable with high contingency levels because I know what happens is the money will just get eaten up. Whatever you put out there, it's just going to – there's no real reason to work hard to keep it under budget. And I know you've given the example of the Orange Line and how that went under budget. And I know, I believe I heard that the Foothill, the first phase, was slightly under budget. Those were, again, all above ground. So we can talk later about this, but I just don't buy into what I'm hearing so far about why the contingency level should be as high as they are. And I think your shop, you need to go back and do a closer look. Because this agency is running out of money, and any time we can save a project or preserve the budget on a project and not go above that budget, the better it is for, as Ms. Molina has articulated, the projects that come along later. We all have a lot of projects, Measure R projects, which we don't have enough funds to build them out sooner than later. And so if we can do a better job on the projects that we have, then that leaves more money for other projects that we are planning to build.
We will definitely take a serious look at that, and Brian is the custodian of all this information,
so
we will work through.
Yeah, Director Wilson, if you like, we can set up a time where we can go through it in more detail and explain to you our thought process.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And anything else? Any other questions? Okay. It's a receive and file. Do you have any follow-up more, any additional presentations?
No.
Okay. We will receive and file that then. Okay. Next, do we have our we don't have a Caltrans.
No, we do not have a Caltrans.
All right. Item 37.
Item 37 is requesting a change for the I-405. We have Mr. Mike Barber, our project director here. This is, again, because of the state law change that we have to go back and negotiate with the contractor to take care of additional requirements imposed on the contract, and Mike will explain what exactly we have to do.
Yeah, essentially right now, before this law change, we had about 7 months a year that we would have to go out and take care of stormwater pollution. After the law change, it's year-round. So the contractor is required to implement things like grass seeding year-round every time we excavate. In addition to that, they have to monitor all of our stormwater pollution activities. So this is a significant change to their activities on the project.
So in this law, legal change, or the change in the law as it relates to this prevention plan, they didn't grandfather any projects. So are these the kinds of things that we run into then?
Absolutely.
At current session, the legislature that could
it's a state-mandated water pollution prevention plan, and Orange Line is going to be affected by that. Yeah.
Do I hear a motion?
Move it.
Okay. Chair, I'll second.
Second.
Okay. Moved and seconded. Any further discussion or questions? Any objections? So ordered. Item 38.
Item 38 is requesting for executing the lease amendment to the building at 777 Figueroa. Velma Marshall and Roger Mollier are here.
This is an existing
lease, is that correct?
Yes, it's been converted from a year-to-year option to a fixed term for the remainder of the 2018. The board authorized a sublease, which had a one-year options. Now we have negotiated with the sublease Marsh to convert it to a full six-year lease at a reduced cost to us. The rent would go down from $24.95 per square foot to $22.25 per square foot, generating a savings over the term of the lease of about $900,000.
Questions?
Yeah, I have a couple.
Okay.
Ms. Marshall, have you taken a look at this owner to see if they are in default or see if they have any troubles with their ownership?
We haven't taken a look, but there was no reason for us to think so. This is a sublease, not with the, directly with the building owner.
I'm just wondering, you know, as I read through this, and maybe you can enlighten me better, it looks like the lease would expire in 2018, so we're a few years short of that now, right? And did they propose this change, or did we propose this change?
We went back to them because we knew that the project was going to be there rather than having to every year renew it to go ahead and lock in the fixed term.
This policy that we're adopting region-wide, or are we just doing it for this particular
project? It's a case-by-case situation.
So why this one instead of some other one?
Well, this is the only one that we have this particular circumstance where we were on a year-to-year option. Generally, we would have tried to our Crenshaw one, we have a fixed 10-year lease there. This one, at the time, it was more expedient to do the year-to-year, but now that things have settled down, we know that the project is there, the improvements have been made, it was an ideal time to make the change.
Has this landlord, be it a tenant relationship, have they been maintaining the building the way we want it? Have they been accommodating to our needs?
This was an extraordinary lease. It's a Class A building. We have a below-market rent lease. The building is, all the changes have been made. If you haven't seen it, I suggest you take a look. We have a wonderful facility
furniture
there.
Comes with it. Mm-hmm. Furniture comes
with it. And the furniture comes with the lease.
Okay. And the building is $41,000, or is that just the portion that we're leasing?
That's the space we occupy. It's the multi-story building. We occupy two floors.
It's a big one, 7 feet. Anything else?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. Do we have a policy as to when we do need space, we go out and look for Class C, B, and then A as our last option, or do we say we want to go out for A, B, and C? Do we look at that at all as a whole for Metro?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand the question.
When we go out and look for space, do we consider at all whether we are looking for Class A space, Class B space, or Class C space, or we go out and look for Class A space, or it doesn't matter, or whatever's convenient?
Well, we don't put, it's whatever is available at the time. We generally have a criteria. We have an area we're looking at, and in this case, we looked at several buildings, and this one provides the best economic offer to us.
Okay. And when this building was built, I don't know how much vacancy is available or what the available space is. Are we fully utilizing the space in this building?
I will defer to Murphy. I think that it's fully occupied.
It's fully occupied.
And when we have an analysis of any space becoming available and property we own?
Well, not within the area that we are looking for. The regional connector, and that's where the project is right next to it. And the west side, of course, will be starting from Wilshire Western. We don't have any property there that I know of.
Buildings.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
All right. Entertain a motion to approve the recommendation. Chair, a second. Without objection, so ordered.
Mr. Chairman, can I recommend take item 40? The same two staff members are involved in item 40.
Okay. Vice Chair of this. Who else can you take over? I'm conflicted.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. Item 40 is a request to authorize the CEO to award a fixed unit rate bench contract to five firms: California Property Specialists, Inc., Dell Richardson & Associates, Epic Land Solutions, Inc., Overland Pacific & Cutler, Inc., and Paragon Partners Limited for acquisition and relocation services in an amount not to exceed a cumulative total of $1 million effective October 1st, 2011. And this is a 10-year contract with a 5-year base and 5 1-year options. Since we're planning to construct several major transportation projects over the next several years, we will need to acquire the real estate required for those projects. The acquisition will include several hundred parcels, full takes, part takes, and easements. It will also require the relocation of several hundred occupants of those properties. With our staffing, we will need additional assistance in fulfilling our requirements to acquire the properties and complete the relocations in the timeline required for the projects. So the bench would allow us additional resources to outreach at times when we need to facilitate our staff.
Can you explain in layman's terms what this means?
It means that we will have a bench of contractors that we can issue task orders to facilitate our acquiring properties for the various projects.
Yeah, let me add, this is really one...
The kind to have like an RFQ process?
I think you hit it right on the head. This is one of the ways we can streamline our procurement process rather than have to go through a complete RFP process when we need someone for several months. This way we pick a bench with a number of very qualified firms, and it enables us to procure that firm much more quickly within a matter of...
In your process in going through this bench, have you already established who's in the pool?
The pool?
The pool of the contractors that you are going to choose from.
Yes, we solicited. We had 13, I think it was, 13, and from that 13, the qualification process dropped it down to the highest 5 scorers who were clearly better in terms of their overall value and price.
Do you know if these contractors that are been narrowed down, are they located in the city or county of Los Angeles?
Yes, they all have local offices here in Los Angeles.
So they have local offices, not necessarily a headquartered office?
Not necessarily. I think they're all primarily L.A. County-based. They may have other offices in other parts of the state, but all of them are primarily in Los Angeles.
Yeah, I think that's true. Because of the nature of the work and having to know the local area in terms of its relocation costs and things like that, they are primarily here. Whether they are technically headquartered right in L.A., I think actually 3 or 4 of them may be, but they all have significant, are they all? Yeah, and they all have very significant presence here just because of the nature of the work.
Yeah, you know what I'd like to do instead of going on what you're thinking? I'd like to go on what really is. So for the board meeting, can you bring back to us, or at least prior to the board meeting, whether these firms are located here or not?
Mr. Wilson, as part of the report, there is a background on each of the contractors. They're all in Southern California, Santa Ana, Inglewood, Torrance, Long Beach, Huntington Beach.
Ms. Marshall, I'm trying to clarify whether they are headquartered here or not. It's easy to have an office here. I can open up an office next door and say I'm here. That doesn't mean that the bulk of my employee base is here. So what I want you to do, if it's in there, then just I'll look at it and take a closer look. But if it's not in there, don't assume that it is and tell me that it is, and then I find out later it isn't. So I prefer if you would just help me understand if they're primarily located here or they just have an office here. And also in the criteria, I want to make sure that you reached out to minority-owned and women-owned businesses and let me know, and you don't have to give the answer to me now, but I'd like to know before the board votes on this whether those who are in the pool are some representatives of folks who are minority or women-owned businesses.
Yes, sir, and that is illustrated in the board report, but I can contact you after and make sure that your questions are addressed.
Thank you.
Yes, Supervisor.
Is this $1 million a year for 10 years or $1 million for the entire 10 years?
A cumulative $1 million for the entire period.
For the 10 years.
So this is just to do what part?
This is our estimate of what the total cost to use these...
Including the lawyers?
No,
that's not the total cost.
No, only for this bench. This bench will be used only to supplement our acquisition activities in terms of negotiating with property owners if we choose to use consultants to do that, to work with relocation of tenants. So it does not include any legal requirements from this bench.
It's only spent if needed.
If needed. And it would be on a task order basis. so that if we decide we're going to use a consultant to acquire 50 properties, say, on the West Side project, we would send out a task order, get their proposals from the five firms, and one that offered the best schedule and cost would then be awarded that particular contract. So it won't be $1 million for each of them. It's whatever that particular portion of it costs. And we just estimate that over the 10-year period, it won't exceed. Or if we do, we'll have to come back.
I just wonder how you look at the budget. Do you look at it at $1 million a year, or do you look like at I got $10 million, so if I use $6 million in the first 3 years, I'm still within my budget?
No, it's $1
million. Everybody reads budgets differently.
Right. No, it's $1 million over the 10-year period. No matter how much we spend, we'll never go over $1 million, whether it happens and whenever it happens. $1 million is
the
grand total.
That's not what she said.
But each year, in terms of the budgeting, we will look and project what we think we'll need for a particular budget year.
Never be in 10 years over $1 million.
When you say never.
I know, but then he said that.
I just want to know what it is. If we have to go over, if we get to that limit, we'll have to come back to you to get a budget adjustment. This is a bench.
Yeah, can I clarify one more time?
It
is,
sure.
It is. We can never spend this year, next year, or cumulatively over 10 years over $1 million. This is all that is approved. So if this year we spend $500 and next year we spend $500, we're finished. We can spend no more money. We would have to come back. We estimate that this amount over the 10-year period will be adequate to cover our needs. And most of this, I may say, are things that actually end up saving us money in the long run. For example, we often run into significant fights about relocation of businesses and things where they'll say the cost for us to relocate is $4 million or $5 million. These specialists are able to parse that down and help us negotiate such that we feel we affect savings. So that's really what the contract is for.
I appreciate that. I mean, savings is not a word you hear around here a lot. And actually delivered. So, but okay, I'm trying to understand the numbers. But thank you for the clarification.
There are motion, you have a follow up question.
Yeah, I do have a follow up question. I just want to clarify what I thought I read here. This says for acquisition and relocation services. So, let's say you're in the pool. You're a firm that's been selected, one of the five that you're recommending. The $1 million does what? What does it do? It just pays for them to be on a retainer?
No. If they are retained to acquire and they submit a proposal, say for $20,000, that would be their fee for the services that they provide.
Okay. So, for example, let's say there's a series of properties that the department or the agency wants to acquire. Do they charge a fee for representing the agency to acquire those properties? Or is this whatever the fee is that we happen to pay, whatever the price is, rather, that we happen to pay for these properties, they're going to get $20,000 if that's what they projected for their fee?
No. They will have to submit a cost proposal when we issue a task order based on the number of hours they expect that they will need to expend to complete the task. If their proposal is 20, they will be able to submit invoices up to that 20,000 mark.
I understand.
It's not a fixed fee. It's based on an hourly rate.
I get that part. That's not the part I'm asking about. My question is, let's say we need them to help us relocate, you know, a number of tenants who live in these properties, right?
Right.
And they say, we're going to charge you $40,000 to do that. I get it. That's what we pay them to do that. But let's say, on the other hand, we want to acquire 20 parcels of properties. And they say, okay, I'll help you acquire those properties. Are they going to be, in turn, earning a fee for the acquisition of those properties, representing this agency as the agent in those property acquisitions?
No, they are only compensated based on the hourly rate. It's not like, being a real estate broker. They get no commission. They get no additional fee.
Right.
They only get paid for the hours that they expend in actually doing the work based on the rates that we've already negotiated.
Okay, I got it. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. You know, when I look at some of these reports, I usually think things cost too much. On this one, I'm looking at it, and it's for 10 years, and it seems kind of low to me. But the reason is because we generally already know the alignment of the routes for the construction of these rail lines. We've got a good sense of how many businesses or residential areas will have to be relocated. And you've done that forecasting, so you've got a sense of what you're going to need. Is that correct?
Yes, and this is to supplement staff. It's not that we're turning over all of the acquisitions to these firms. We will determine when we need to supplement our staff and to meet schedule. We generally only, in the past, have only contracted out for relocation services, but this time we added the additional ability to contract out some of the acquisition.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I might add this. This is an unusual situation in that we have literally scheduled I think it's 350 in the next year. So, I mean, it's a huge load, and it's because of the accelerated building program. If we want to keep ahead of the schedule such that the people building will be able to do it, we need to get out in front of that.
We already have our internal staff that assists with relocation.
We have a full-service real estate staff, appraisers, acquisition officers, but we don't have relocation specialists. That's a specialized field that is best to get consultants to do. We have on board senior officers who are available. We also have, we're recruiting for an additional position at this time. But the quantity of work far exceeds the number of staff that we could staff up to do.
Okay. And finally, who can I speak with about our ability to assist residential tenants to become homeowners? For example, when I was on the Board of Education, we established a policy that should we relocate a residential tenant with the compensation they're receiving from school district, they have the ability then to move forward and purchase and become a homeowner. At that time, we worked with the City of Los Angeles Housing Authority to be able to complete that. So I'd want to talk to somebody offline to see if we could do that here if possible. Is there someone I could speak to about that offline?
Who should I guess you could speak with me. Part of the relocation services provided is relocation advisory services, and certainly if a tenant wants to convert to an owner, the relocation consultant can help them use mm-hmm. existing services.
Okay. I'd like to speak to you more about that afterwards. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay. Boris? Here, I'll move it. Is there a second?
Second.
Without objection, so ordered. Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. Withdraw my.
Okay, he's going to withdraw his motion. I'll move it. He's conflicted, so we need another. We need a second on this item.
I'm conflicted.
You're conflicted as well.
No, I was told I didn't have any
conflict.
Oh, Mr. Canabias. Okay,
I move that, and we need a second.
Second.
Okay. Any further discussion? We have any public comment on this one? Okay, without objection and with abstention, so ordered.
Okay, thank you. We are back at item number 39.
Mr. Diego Cardos, I will make the presentation.
Good morning, directors. Back in 2009, the board had a very robust discussion about installing gates in the East Side Gold Line, and they asked us to conduct the appropriate studies, environmental studies, for us to determine how we do that. The strategy that we follow basically is to proceed with that, but also at the same time observe what was going on in the Gold Line in terms of its operations. One of the very important tasks that we conducted in that process was to have a traffic simulation, which basically in cooperation with the county and the city and other entities, we simulated the installation of gates in the community for several days. And then we found that some of it we already knew, but through that simulation we were able to understand better the extent of the impacts in terms of the traffic impacts if we stand at the gates. At the same time that we were doing that, we were also looking at different ways that we could deal in order to best manage and increase the safety on the East Side Goal Line, and also have lots of meetings with community and stakeholders along the alignment in order to understand their expectations as well as to what they were observing when we were working there. Robin Blair from my staff is going to walk you through the study if necessary. Robin, could you please briefly indicate what we did?
Per the recommendation of the board, we did several things. One is to start the environmental process for clearances, meet with PUC and the other agencies that were involved, and also to focus upon the issues that have been raised, which is the perception that there may be some unsafe conditions, as well as the issues of looking at how do we resolve the issues of either in some cases actual conflicts or the perceptions of unsafe conditions. There were about 25 things that we had put into place, including rather extensive fencing to prevent mid-block crossings or people crossing the tracks. Along with this process of meeting both with the PUC and then ultimately even the FTA and ultimately, as we're recommending today, with the FHWA, we looked at both what had been successfully implemented other places and then what could be implemented at MTA initially as well. So where we are today, after running the simulation, looking through the incident reports, evaluating them, where we are today is the number one issue we're trying to resolve now is called a left turn or blind left turn. Of the 14 incidences of accidents along the goal line, 11 of them have been left turns. Or blind left turns. There have been no significant injuries. There have been these incidences of a train and car contact, though. Our recommendation at this point is to try and focus upon those improvements. They would include a in-street lighting, which is a demonstration project with the FHWA in concurrence with the FTA and the City and County of Los Angeles Departments of Transportation. In doing so, we are hoping to raise the awareness and to stop or alter the behavior that is causing the incidents. It would also include some other variations of our current traffic signals, and that would be to realign them, replace them, to refocus them so the public is more aware. We're also looking at some enhanced signage at strategic locations for the same reason, focusing upon trying to resolve the number one issue or the last we call it significant issue of traffic behavior. So that's where we are today. In addition, you have attached a report of the simulation, and there are several key issues which we want to focus on. One is the quad gates as we have been directed. While they can in most cases be installed, they have significant and what is largely unmitigatable consequences. One of those consequences is a significant impact to traffic to the point of not being able to clear intersections during peak hours. The second issue of significant concern is that emergency response vehicles may lose anywhere from a minute to 2 minutes in their responses, and that has a potential for a significant impact as well. And less significant, but certainly as important to the community, is the potential impacts to businesses during peak hours because of the delay in traffic and the undesirability of going in these areas with automobiles. And we bring those to your attention because certainly the board can have a finding of an overriding consideration, but before the board takes that action or considers that any actions in that direction, we would like to look at other methods that we still have the potential to install to try and reduce any perception of an unsafe condition. And I hope that summarizes what we're trying to do here today.
Any questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
First of all, let me thank the folks that have been involved with this. I appreciate the interactive aspect with the community and those issues. But even with all of that, I think that I explained to you the other day my own personal situation with my left turn. And it's still dangerous out there. And, you know, we're not going to know the danger until there's a car with six children that are killed. And that's probably when everyone will pay attention. But I appreciate every effort that is being made here. This last proposal, I think, is a good one. I'm not opposed to it. But it is a reminder to all of us, again, of course we're going to have, if we put up the gates, we're going to have traffic delays, which is why we wanted a subway on the east side. The issue is safety. And so, yes, for people who pass through our communities, and we would have to find mitigations for that ambulance and that fire truck as well. But I really am nervous about those left turns. I know when I was there, it was a real problem. And, of course, you said that was like a – that happens because sometimes the – what did you call it? The timing isn't correct or something, right?
Correct.
There isn't a number that I can call because there's not a big red light that goes on in his house to tell him, oh, heck, the timing is off on that left turn.
So watch out.
Huh?
So be careful.
No, not be careful.
Fix it.
Because that's when people make the left turn, is when they're, it's the timing is off. I stayed there a long, long time. And it happens, and not everybody is like myself. I mean, you know, they don't have anyone to talk to about it. And believe me, I thought about making the illegal left turn, but it was difficult because you can't see if a train's coming behind you and you can't see if a train's coming in front of you. But I bet you that those folks, there might be folks that would take that risk with the idea that they're going to make it. So quad gates by far are the safest, and they're the most cumbersome. The community doesn't want quad gates either. They would like to have had a subway, but that's again, it's only, I continue to put it in here, because that is one of the problems with having an above ground. It creates a disruption to the traffic as is. But the issue is that until we have the full measurement of safety, this proposal that you have in place, this additional safety features, I think is a good one. I'd like to post his cell number on a little sign when that left turn is 5 minutes long, so I could call him and say, okay, well, he's agreeing to put up his cell number on the corner of all those left turns so that if there is a problem, they can call him and then he can call you, right?
If it saves a life, we should do it.
I know, but nobody's going to do that. I mean, it's nice and just, but the reality is we do need a phone number, one with somebody on the other end, not a recording, saying that there is a problem, because I don't think enough people report it. I mean, I only reported it to you because you happened to come up and talk to me about it. Otherwise, I probably would have forgotten about it as well. But I do think that we do need those signs up. Have a number to call, because if the sequencing or the timing of those lights is off, someone's going to take the risk. And that's the problem. Because you sit there impatiently waiting for a left turn signal, and it's not happening, and it's not happening, and it's not happening, as was in my case. You're going to run for the illegal left turn, and that's the danger.
We take that very seriously. I already asked one of the persons that's helping us, Sammy Wassef, that used to work with LADOT, to look into that. He specifically went there and sat off serve and then talked to LADOT. So this will be part of our fine-tuning the operations of the goal line and coming up with technical solutions to best deal with that. So and we will take this under consideration and proceed.
And you will put up that phone number?
My boss already said that he's going to do it.
All right. He's got it right here, so unless you come up with another one. He's there to answer it, but I don't know how good he is at answering his own phone. But the point is you need somebody to be there in case that happens. All right? Thank you.
All right. We have a number of – pardon me?
Just a quick question. Can you briefly explain an in-roadway warning light? What exactly is that?
I may have a picture right here. If you see where the lights are in the street,
mm-hmm.
here, this is an in-roadway lighting system. It goes with a signal. We're looking at this system, probably going to double the lights. We'll look at the manufacturer and others to make sure this is a much more visible appearance. It works as a warning in addition to the lighting so that there is another level of awareness, and that's the thing that we've been looking at. We also are looking at, if I can show you one more, which is this little light up here is a LED backlight for the left turn, which is giving a more complete or a more defined notice that there is something special here. Don't take the left turn. This is two of the items that we're looking at installing. We are also looking at others. These are the two where we have some measure of success with them, and we're looking at how we can add these and or others to raise that awareness and bring it to the attention of the person taking the left turn. That has been the focus.
Gotcha. And these are additional features, but it doesn't end here, correct?
Say again?
It doesn't end here. We will continuously look at other safety measures, check on the performance of these, see what else we can do. Board Member Molina pointed out phone numbers, whatever else. We're going to continuously be thinking and evaluating about what else we can do here, correct?
Correct. In fact, as recently as last week, the FTA's Washington representative for the research on these kind of devices was here, going over both what we're trying to do and also bringing to our attention things that they have tried other places. We're trying to work with them, and it's a very good relationship, to even look at things as exotic as focused sound or other things that will potentially help solve this problem. They will be monitoring what we're installing. If this works successfully, it becomes a model for other systems throughout the United States as well. So there is a very vested interest in seeing what we do, how we do, and if it's successful, how it can be applied to other places.
Thank you.
Hey, we have several folks have signed up. First of all, Sherry Breskin, followed by Eddie Torres, followed by Rita Rodriguez.
So good afternoon. I'm Sherry Breskin. I'm the retired principal of Ramona Opportunity High School, and I made an illegal left-hand turn in front of Our Lady of Lourdes Church. I'm here to confess it.
Because you were patient.
Yes. You know what? I didn't see the red arrow. I was driving west on 3rd Street, and I turned left. I couldn't see it because of the sunset. So I'm here to really support all these other things that could make it much more clear. I saw a youthful pedestrian today crossing on State Street. The yellow lights were blinking. It was really a wonderful thing. Traffic stopped. The pedestrian crossed, and everybody went about their business. My only suggestion is that maybe when we talk to the companies that provide these lights, we ask them to put purple and gold lights in favor of the Lakers. So that will definitely get a lot of people's attention. Thank you.
Clever.
Thank you. Eddie Torres, followed by Rita Rodriguez.
Good afternoon, board members. My name is Eddie Torres, and I'm here representing the East Los Angeles Chamber of Commerce. I also sit on the MTA Review Advisory Committee. The businesses along 3rd Street in Los Angeles County the businesses along 3rd Street in Los Angeles County have been affected by the MTA Gold Line construction. And also, during the time of the May impacts on the lights, the simulation of lights, there was either no business for the businesses between Woods and Atlantic, and also a big delay for Kaiser Permanente appointment persons. The East LA Chamber of Commerce is opposed to any gates and further impacts to the East LA businesses and along the Gold Line extension. Thank you for consideration in this matter.
Hey, thank you. Rita Rodriguez, followed by Diana Tarango.
My name is Rita Govea Rodriguez. I am on the Review Advisory Committee. I am also with the 14th District Coalition and Homeowners Association. I have a business on 1st in Indiana. I also grew up on South Indiana. And I am for the lighting that they want to put up. Also, there is one big problem on the south east corner of 1st Street where the goal line kind of turns going south and going west. The pedestrians stand very close to the tracks. There needs to be a gate there like they do for the gates to go into the stations. So that's my recommendation. Thank you.
Diana Tarango, followed by John Walsh.
Good morning. My name is Diana Tarango, and I'm the co-chair of the RAC Review Advisory Committee for the Gold Line in East Los Angeles. And I have to go along with the idea that the most important thing with the Gold Line is the safety. Understanding that there are three grammar schools along that alignment, and the kids are let out of school at 3 o'clock, and mothers are going for their children. And again, as our supervisor said, that left-hand turn on Rowan is a very dangerous left-hand turn because the arrow is set where you can hardly see it. It's very light. We need it in a darker color or whatever way to make it safety. My concern is the safety of our community. I've lived there all my life, and I have seen the situation as it is right now. The goal line is running very, very smooth, very well, but safety, you've got to look at the safety of the children as they go to school and come out of school, and I thank you very much.
Thank you. John Walsh, followed by Chris Sutton.
John Walsh, blogging at HollywoodHighlands.org. We have a new post out today. You know, I said this, these safety problems. Well, let's explain. Ms. Molina built a system, came in pretty much on schedule and almost on budget, okay, the original budget. Zev Yaroslavsky, that was for Mexicans. Zev Yaroslavsky and the West Side, his project is almost $200 million over budget and 2 years behind schedule. And the safety, when that opens, will be the best in the world because it's for white people. Now, Ms. Molina, if you disagree with anything I say, I'll give you my time. And I'm telling you, I've said it before, and it's on Story and Times, Jews versus Mexicans. If Zev runs for mayor, come on the east side. He hasn't been there since the opening of the line. He's a racist. Ms. Molina, you can
Mr. Walsh, Mr. Walsh. You have 3 seconds to discuss the issue, not to make racial comments. Chris Sutton. Chris Sutton, and then followed by Wajiha.
I'm only speaking on this item to contrast the distinction between how the East Side Gold Line was managed and delivered with how the Foothill Gold Line is being managed and delivered. And I'll speak again on item 42. I didn't put in a card for 62, but you have much more control. You have much more information on what's going on in terms of the staff, in terms of safety, when you're managing the project yourself. And it is our contention that the Foothill Gold Line is being mismanaged and you are being misled regarding that mismanagement. Thank you.
Thank you. Wajiha.
Good afternoon. Thank you for letting me speak. Coral Fellow 91. I'm in Watts, and I appreciate what you all are doing, and I'm not too good at this. But after you do the study and everything on the GO line, I would like for you all to come to Watts and 103rd. We have the largest concentration of children there, and I've been assisting the schools and the children with the crossing. We have 4 tracks there, UP, and SP, and we have the Blue Line, and we have like almost 3,200 ridership, and it's quite hard on me now. I'm getting older. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, the audience before us.
Move it.
Move and seconded. Any further discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Thank you.
Thank you for your work.
I just want to recognize Eric Carlson and Henry Gonzalez, who were doing the work out there in the field.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay. Yes.
Item number 41, Mr. Chairman. We were late in concluding our negotiations with the City of Los Angeles regarding their FY12 annual work program. So we want to bring it to the full board. Now we have concluded the negotiations. Okay. Last one is item 42.
All right, 42. What is the difference between this and what we just did?
I was just going to say this item is very similar to our previous discussions on project budgets and contingencies for the construction authority, so I would propose I don't make a presentation, but if you have any questions on the item, I'd be happy to answer.
Are there any additional questions on this? Okay. It's very similar to the one we had before. Okay, thank you. We do have a public comment. Mr. Sutton again.
The Foothill Extension Gold Line is purchasing property from Monrovia at 4 times its appraised value, property next door to my client. The reason they're doing that is they failed to analyze in their EIR or in any of their design or economic analysis There's several other sites for this maintenance and operation yard. Two sites in Irwindale are larger and cheaper. The site in Azusa is much larger and much cheaper, yet they chose to go into Monrovia because there was, up until recently, a Monrovia city council person on the Gold Line board. The reason why the Gold Line is being mismanaged is because they don't have the ability to tell contractors that in the future you're not going to get any contracts with us. The MTA has more leverage with contractors than these local authorities do. In addition, the MTA would not have overpaid for this land, and we have in effect, there's an injunction to stop it. But we believe you need to deeply, deeply look into the Gold Line management and costs on a wide range of areas. You need to suspend the payments to them reallocate the money.
Thank you. Mr. Walsh.
John Walsh, blogging at HollywoodHighlands.org, 100,000 successful server requests a month, and now we have video on there. You can see what I do in front of these organizations. But I've known Chris Sutton for about 25 years. He actually got two of the members of the board over there on the extension booted out because it was unlawful. Now they're going to Sacramento to change the law. Remember, any time we're successful with the law, you change the law. And I just want to say, if there's anybody up there, a minority, who thinks I'm a racist, you got 24 seconds because I attack my own race.
Thank you.
I'm waiting.
All right, we'll receive and file the report. Thank you.
Can I ask a question, Mr. Yes. Chair? The authorities, a general question, the authorities that we have, they manage the projects for Metro, they're on their own. And earlier in the year we had a discussion about their legal liability and us having to pay for decisions they make, and we are stuck with a bill. I'm just watching these authorities right now. We're having to pay more for the projects. I mean, is it the same type of situation when we're stuck with a bill on decisions that are made somewhere else? Is that an accurate assessment?
Well, we do have agreements with these authorities that lay out what our responsibilities are versus the construction authorities. And Charles can certainly get into the legalities of that. But just in general, we do get very involved with these projects as well, even though they're in fact constructed by a different authority. We treat them as one of our own in terms of overseeing their progress, cost, and schedule. We try to get them to comply with a lot of the policies we use on our own projects. But at the end of the day, yes, if there's a cost increase, these authorities don't have other funding sources to tap into. They're single-purpose organizations. So ultimately, if there is a problem, they would have to comply with our cost containment policy and come back to the board with any request for additional funding.
And some of our policies apply to them, others don't. The more I hear about this, the more I see it's an interesting relationship we have with them. And they are created through state legislation, correct?
That's correct.
And do we here locally have the ability or inability to even go in that direction, or have we evaluated whether these authorities are in the best interest of the Metro and the region, et cetera? I mean, that's a highly charged question, I understand, but the more I've been listening and watching, it's just there's more problems that keep arising, and big problems, millions of dollars worth of problems that probably could be averted. I don't want to go into that now. It's a charged question, but it's an observation. Thank you.
We've got somebody out there in billable hours, too. Be careful. With that, like I said, we receive and file. Now we'd go to public comments. John Walsh. Then we'll go into operations under the great, incredible leadership of Ara Najarian.
John Walsh, blogging at HollywoodHighlands.org. You know, the reason the East Side Line has had many problems is that Richard Alatorre and Art Snyder didn't get their dirty hands on it. And dirty hands is a phrase that one member of this board used about him when Alatorre was on this board. And I'm telling you right now, someone was stabbed to death on the subway. It was not the sheriff's fault. It's your fault, because you have directed much too much of the energy of the sheriffs on catching people fare evasion, while fare evasion should be minor and keeping us from being stabbed to death. And again, because the white reporter at the LA Times was an eyewitness. And incidentally, you had one death murder before at Hollywood and Highland, and it was covered in the press when a gangster threw another gangster onto the tracks and he was killed. This is the second death. And it's time to let the sheriffs go after the murderers, not those who are stealing a dollar and a quarter from you.
Thank you. With kindness, gracious ending, we will adjourn the meeting. Okay? And then the Operations Committee goes into session. For incredible leadership, though.